from the heart of our nation's capital in Washington, D.C., bringing compelling interviews, insightful analysis, taking you beyond the headlines and sound bites into conversations with our nation's leaders and newsmakers, all from a biblical worldview. Sitting in for Tony is today's host, Joseph Backholm.
Hello and welcome to this Friday edition of Washington Watch. I'm Joseph Backholm, sitting for Tony. Pleasure to be with you. Before we get going on the program, I want to bring a quick reminder that time is running out and you are invited to join us in Washington, D.C. from October 3rd through October 6th for our Pray, Vote, Stand Summit. This national gathering of spiritually active, governance-engaged conservatives, or SAGECONs, recognizes that change must flow from spiritual renewal. Registration is now open, and please join us as we pray for our nation, engage in government and culture, and stand for biblical truth. Visit prayvotestand.org for details and to register. Today on the program, a number of stories for you. Good news out of New York as an attempt to silence the speech of pregnancy resource centers has been halted by a federal judge. We'll give you those details. Also, the state of North Carolina just removed 700,000 names from their voter rolls because they shouldn't have been there in the first place. Does this suggest there are similar problems in other states? And will cleaning up the voter rolls end up making a difference in the November elections? We'll give you that story. Also, as Israel continues to fight for its survival, the conflict raises many questions about the ethics of war. When the purpose is killing people, when do military decisions and tactics become wrong? We'll talk about that in our worldview segment with David Claussen at the end of the program. But our headline for today, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu addressed the United Nations General Assembly earlier today, issuing a warning to Iran that attacks on Israel will be met with a reprisal. He also pushed back against criticism that other speakers at the United Nations had been delivering throughout the week against the Jewish nation.
In this battle between good and evil, there must be no equivocation. When you stand with Israel, you stand for your own values and your own interests. Yes, we're defending ourselves, but we're also defending you against a common enemy that through violence and terror seeks to destroy our way of life.
The speech comes as the Biden-Harris administration and other nations work to broker a multi-week ceasefire in the conflict between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon. Earlier today, the Prime Minister's office acknowledged the U.S.'s effort toward a ceasefire, even as Netanyahu has pledged to keep striking Hezbollah militants in Lebanon with, quote, all our might. Now, joining me now with his analysis of this ongoing situation is Dr. A.J. Nolte, chair of the Government Graduate Program and director of the International Development MA program at Regent University. He's also director of the Institute for Israel Studies at Regent University. Dr. Nolte, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Joseph, it's great to be here again, and it feels like kind of a homecoming coming back to Washington Watch after being here earlier in the week as well.
Well, we're glad to have you because there is so much happening in the region, and we do want to understand it. Your thoughts on Prime Minister Netanyahu's address today?
Well, I will say many times in recent history, Prime Minister Netanyahu has found himself in controversy within Israel. There is nothing that he said today, I think, that any Israeli or supporter of Israel or even serious person is going to have much of an objection to. He was a serious person addressing what has become an unserious institution. Let's take, for example, the conflict that you mentioned with Hezbollah in the past. Hezbollah has been, as the Prime Minister noted, has been in violation of a UN resolution, Resolution 1701, since 2005. 2005, the UN passed a resolution that said that Hezbollah needed to withdraw beyond the Litani River, which is a river in Lebanon, and said that Hezbollah needed to disarm along with all of the other militias in Lebanon. This is something that's been a standing requirement on Hezbollah in international law for decades since the end of the Lebanese civil war. Now, the problem is that Hezbollah is not primarily a Lebanese actor. It is, as the Prime Minister pointed out, a proxy of Iran. And so as a result of that, they are not complying with that. And the UN, rather than taking its own resolution seriously and holding Hezbollah, which is not in compliance. Yet again, they are going to try to raise more objections to and more criticisms of Israel. And so, again, the UN is not even taking itself seriously. And I think the Prime Minister did an able job of pointing out many of the problems with the UN's unbalanced treatment of Israel as compared to every other country in the world.
Dr. Nolte, explain why Prime Minister Netanyahu feels the need to give this address to the UN if it has become, as you describe it, kind of an unserious institution, in part because it doesn't even enforce its own rules, its own policies, its own standards.
I think one of Prime Minister Netanyahu's strengths is that he understands international communication, he understands the international environment, and he knows that if the only thing that people are hearing from these UN forums are these condemnations of Israel, and there's no balance provided to that, that is going to become, that's only going to strengthen the narrative. And of course, he's very familiar with the UN. As he mentioned in his speech in 1984, he was giving a very similar speech in a very similar set of circumstances, at least from within the UN. And so he's very familiar with that forum. And so I think part of that is going into an area where we're hearing a lot of nonsense and speaking truth, and also providing a counterpoint in an area where if he doesn't speak up, that counterpoint may not be provided. There have been times in the past where the U.S. has provided that counterpoint. We could think of the U.N. ambassadorship of Nikki Haley during the Trump administration, where she was a forceful counter to a lot of the anti-Israel nonsense that was coming out of the U.N. Unfortunately, while the U.S. has oftentimes voted to block some of the anti-Israel stuff, they're not really playing that same role of speaking truth in the U.N. And so I feel like Prime Minister Netanyahu felt it was important to do that in this particular moment in time.
Well, meanwhile, Israel continues to take out the top level of Hezbollah's leadership in Lebanon. While there are discussions of a ceasefire, they are certainly not engaged in a ceasefire. What are the latest developments there in Israel's attempt to take out Hezbollah?
Yeah. So a couple of points that it's always important to keep in mind as we're framing this question of a ceasefire. And the most important of these is to keep in mind that Hezbollah initiated this round of violence to the point that large chunks of northern Israel, as the Prime Minister mentioned in his speech, have been evacuated since for going on for a year now, since the start of the war in the south. Iran mobilizing Hezbollah to do that in an attempt to open up a second front against Israel and put pressure on them after October 7th, okay? So that's the first point that we need to keep in mind. Oftentimes, there can be very strong sense of historical amnesia here, where we're forgetting that this didn't start a week ago when Israel pulled off a very successful intelligence operation with the Pagers. In terms of the ceasefire, I think it's unlikely. I think it's unlikely for two reasons. One, Hezbollah is an existential threat to Israel. They are much more sophisticated in many ways than Hamas, and the Israelis are rightly concerned that Hezbollah will be able to do much worse than October 7th if Israel lets its guard down, and Israel's very firmly never again with that. The second is that, again, Hezbollah is a proxy for Iran. They're not acting in the interest of Lebanon. They're not even acting in the interest, really, of the Shia population in Lebanon. They're acting entirely in the interest of Iran. And so as a result of that, they are absolutely going to continue to pressure Israel as part of Iran's attempt to really escalate things against Israel. So I think a ceasefire is very unlikely because it's not in Israel's interest, and it's not in the interests of Iran, who are the prime movers in Hezbollah.
Well, in light of that, Prime Minister Netanyahu, in his he released a statement earlier today saying that he, quote, appreciates the U.S. efforts towards a ceasefire in Lebanon. In light of what you've just told us about the reality on the ground and the unlikeliness of the ceasefire, is it true that the U.S. continues to push in that direction? And what are the political dynamics there?
I think the political dynamics are pretty straightforward. There's a lot of concern right now about the upcoming elections within the Biden administration. And the last thing they want is for the Middle East to explode right before the November elections. Because, again, a lot of this happened on their watch. And if we're going to be very honest, President Biden in his person and his administration in general have been weak on Iran. While they have been not as bad as some in the Democratic Party in terms of Israel itself. And of course, it's always great that they say that Israel has the right to defend itself, which Israel has without the U.S. saying that. It has that intrinsically. But they have been very bad on Iran. And they've backed away from President Trump's maximum pressure campaign, which was having an effect on Iran. And so I think they're very concerned that if this escalates, that's going to come back to bite them politically. So I think that's a lot of what's going on, is they want to calm things down. How do we get a ceasefire? I mean, look, there could be a ceasefire tomorrow. If Hezbollah obeyed the UN resolution 1701, withdrew beyond the Litani River, disarmed itself, stopped acting as a proxy of Iran, and became a normal political party like every other militia that existed during the Lebanese Civil War has been forced to do. The chances of that happening, unfortunately, are pretty slim. But there's that's the pathway. That's how we get to a ceasefire. And unfortunately, those decisions are getting made by Hassan Nasrallah and by his backers in Tehran. And I don't know how much we're going to be able to really influence that.
Well, you seem to have a lot of clarity as to how to reach a ceasefire that the rest of the region does not have. And so there seems to be something what Netanyahu has referred to as some moral confusion. I want to play part of what he has said. He said earlier today and give you a chance to respond. Let's play clip three.
There should be no confusion about this. But unfortunately, there is a lot of it in many countries. And in this very hall, as I've just heard, good is portrayed as evil, and evil is portrayed as good. We see this moral confusion when Israel is falsely accused of genocide, when we defend ourselves against enemies who try to commit genocide against us.
Dr. Nolte, is that a fair characterization?
Yes, it is. The claims of Israel committing genocide are patently ridiculous. They're patently ridiculous not only because of the substantial presence of Arab citizens of Israel, or 20% of the Israeli population, and have some of the highest standards of living in the Middle East of any Arabs in the Middle East. They're also patently ridiculous because Israel has been attempting to bring in food and humanitarian aid into Gaza, and has been very clear that while they want to remove Hamas from leadership in Gaza, that they would be supportive of a demilitarized but locally administered civilian authority in Gaza, as the prime minister said. They don't want to go back into to Gaza. They left in 2005. So the idea that this is sort of genocide or ethnic cleansing or anything like that, I think is just, it's patently false. And so I think that part of the reason why this genocide claim is being made is because it is, you know, in some ways a slap at this nation that was founded by Holocaust survivors more than it is an attempt to realistically meet the internationally recognized definitions for genocide.
Well, Dr. A.J. Nolte, thank you so much for your time today. And before we let you go, and we appreciate this, I just want to make sure people know there's a lot more where this came from coming up at the Pray Vote Stand Summit, where you will be participating in a panel on this very subject. And there will be an even longer form discussion, and we are looking forward to that. I want to remind people they can go to prayvotestand.org to find that. So, Dr. Nolte, thank you for your time today, and we look forward to seeing you next weekend.
Thank you. Look forward to being there.
Coming up after the break, we have some good news out of New York. Pregnancy resource centers, after a preliminary injunction from our federal judge, may no longer be required to say things they don't want to say and be allowed to say the things they do want to say. We'll tell you more when we come back. Stay with us.
Are you a Christian parent looking to raise a spiritual champion in today's culture? Renowned author George Barna has written a new book, Raising Spiritual Champions. This book offers valuable insights based on extensive research conducted by George Barna, the Family Research Council, and Arizona Christian University. Learn how to help your children discern biblical truth and find compelling meaning and purpose. Don't miss out on this essential resource for parents. Order your copy today.
Hello, I'm Jody Heiss, president of FRC Action. Here in America, we thank God for the right to vote, and we can all agree on the importance of this upcoming election. Many of us want to support candidates who share our values, but we're not comfortable supporting the big national political organizations. Well, we have a solution for supporting candidates through FRC Action's Faith, Family, and Freedom Fund. Being a super PAC, It allows for unlimited individual and corporate donations, so we can endorse and fund campaigns for people who share our values. By giving to this fund, we're able to pull all of our contributions together and support and endorse like-minded candidates. That's how we move the needle. So let's be the best stewards possible and get the most out of our political contributions by uniting our efforts. For more information or to contribute, visit faithfamilyfreedomfund.org. Thank you so much, and God bless you.
All of us are born with the desire to find truth and meaning. Where did I come from? What happens when I die? While our answers to these questions may divide us, we are united in our need for the freedom to answer life's biggest questions and make life's biggest decisions for ourselves. That's why religious freedom matters for everyone. Religious freedom matters because the powerful have long wanted to control those who are less powerful. Religious freedom matters because the freedom of those who are different is often threatened by those who believe different is dangerous. At the Center for Religious Liberty at Family Research Council, we promote religious freedom for everyone because the only alternative is religious freedom for no one. We encourage Americans and the American government to engage and advocate for the persecuted, and they do. We work every day to bring good news to the afflicted, to proclaim liberty to captives and freedom to prisoners. We do it because that's what Jesus does. We work to give freedom to others because we ourselves have been set free.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Joseph Backholm, sitting in for Tony today. This week, a federal judge issued a preliminary injunction that blocks New York Attorney General Letitia James from silencing constitutionally protected speech from two pro-life organizations discussing the safety and efficacy of abortion pill reversals. Now, in August, Thomas More Society attorneys filed a federal lawsuit against Attorney General James on behalf of the pregnancy care centers, outlining how James's threats of prosecution and intimidation violates the First and 14th Amendments of the United States Constitution. The lawsuit argued that James's targeting of these organizations unconstitutionally chills their speech on the safety and efficacy of the abortion pill reversal. Joining me now to discuss this is Mary Zock, Director of the Center for Human Dignity at FRC. Mary, good to see you today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, first, before we get into the injunction, tell us about what Attorney General Letitia James was trying to do to the pregnancy centers.
Well, in May of this year, Attorney General Letitia James actually sued 11 pregnancy resource centers and Heartbeat International in New York for their advertisement of abortion pill reversal. She falsely claimed that this was deceptive advertising, that she claimed that abortion pill reversal is unsafe and that it's ineffective, both of which are not true. But in doing this, she attempted to silence them and to prevent them from advertising abortion pill reversal. And she attempted to extract payment for having previously advertised this. So these two centers that received the injunction today were not part of the initial group that she sued, but their speech was understandably curtailed because of her original attempt to silence those 11 pregnancy resource centers.
So she was telling them that you're not allowed to tell women that the abortion pill reversal even exists, or you're not allowed to distribute it?
She was saying that you're not allowed to tell them that it even exists, that you're not allowed to promote it and advertise it. She, in a statement, said abortions cannot be reversed. It's really puzzling and saddening that she does not want women who have taken the first drug in the abortion pill regimen, mifepristone, to know that they, in fact, could have a chance of reversing the effects of that drug. She wants them to think that once they have taken that drug, which often is done on impulse, that is a one and done thing. When really, if it is immediately counteracted with progesterone, there is a chance to save that unborn baby's life.
Well, it is interesting in light of the pro-woman, pro-choice narrative that they have created, that they would take the position that you're not allowed to change your mind. That does not seem very pro-woman or pro-child. And it suggests that, in fact, they are more pro-abortion than pro-woman or pro-choice. But Mary, tell us about the decision from the federal judge this week.
Well, what the federal judges said was that the attorney general is not allowed to curtail their speech, that this is a violation of their First Amendment rights, and that they can advertise this, which is a huge win for women in New York. We've seen that once women take that first pill, that mifepristone pill, that a number of women immediately experience regret, that they recognize that perhaps there is a way forward for them and their unborn child, and that many women frantically search the internet for some way to reverse what they have done. And these pregnancy resource centers are providing that lifeline to these mothers. And thank goodness they will be allowed to continue to do so as this lawsuit plays out.
Yeah, indeed. And we know a preliminary injunction is only a preliminary injunction. And when it is granted, that means there is still a trial to be had. But a preliminary injunction is granted when the judge determines that they are likely to succeed at trial. And so that's certainly a strong indication, though not the final answer. How many pregnancy centers does this cover? Is this a case that involves everyone in the state of New York? Is it broader than that?
Well, this injunction was tailored toward two pregnancy resource centers in particular that sued the attorney general because of their decision to stop advertising for abortion pill reversal because of her intimidating remarks. But we can expect to see this type of thing continue. We know in Colorado last year, they passed a law actually attempting to ban abortion pill reversal and to prevent pro-life health centers from distributing progesterone for the purpose of reversing the effects of mifepristone. And in New York, as I said earlier, we have seen that the attorney general sued 11 pregnancy resource centers for advertising this. This is an attempt to promote abortion, to force women into that decision. And it's something that has to be stopped.
Yeah, Mary, to that point that this is an attempt not to promote choice, but to promote abortion, let's remember the broader context, because we have other states like California who have passed legislation saying you must advertise for abortion if you have a communication with a pregnant woman. So they were going to these same pregnancy centers who are unambiguously pro-life, and that's the reason they exist, and then telling them that you have to tell women how to get an abortion and where they can get an abortion, which is exactly the thing they're trying to prevent. So this goes to a broader state of mind, doesn't it? Just about what we're dealing with culturally and the attitude of the left on the issue of abortion.
It absolutely does. And their claims that the abortion pill reversal is ineffective and unsafe are completely unfounded. Abortion pill reversal is effective over 60% of the time if it's taken within 72 hours of ingesting that first drug, mifepristone. And the use of progesterone to aid the continuation of pregnancy is incredibly safe. It's often even given to women who experience repeat miscarriages, like myself, to help them carry a child to term. So this is not something that pro-lifers are just pulling out of the blue and just trying for fun. This is a proven method of helping women to continue pregnancy, and it's effective, and that's why the pro-abortion industry hates it.
And part of the movement is just maintaining and preserving the freedom to say the things that are true, because in this case, they protect life. Mary Zock, thanks for your time today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Coming up next, 700,000 names removed from the voter rolls in North Carolina. What does this mean about the past and the future in the election to come? We'll talk about it when we return.
Everything we do begins as an idea. Before there can be acts of courage, there must be the belief that some things are worth sacrificing for. Before there can be marriage, there is the idea that man should not be alone. Before there was freedom, there was the idea that individuals are created equal. It's true that all ideas have consequences, but we're less aware that all consequences are the fruit of ideas. Before there was murder, there was hate. Before there was a Holocaust, there was the belief by some people that other people are undesirable. Our beliefs determine our behavior, and our beliefs about life's biggest questions determine our worldview. Where did I come from? Who decides what is right and wrong? What happens when I die? Our answers to these questions explain why people see the world so differently. Debates about abortion are really disagreements about where life gets its value. Debates over sexuality and gender and marriage are really disagreements about whether the rules are made by us or for us. What we think of as political debates are often much more than that. They're disagreements about the purpose of our lives and the source of truth. As Christians, our goal must be to think biblically about everything. Our goal is to help you see beyond red and blue, left and right, to see the battle of ideas at the root of it all. Our goal is to equip Christians with a biblical worldview and help them advance and defend the faith in their families, communities, and the public square. Cultural renewal doesn't begin with campaigns and elections. It begins with individuals turning from lies to truth. But that won't happen if people can't recognize a lie and don't believe truth exists. We want to help you see the spiritual war behind the political war, the truth claims behind the press release, and the forest from the trees.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Joseph Backholm, sitting in for Tony today. This week, the North Carolina State Board of Electors announced that more than 700,000 voters have been removed from the state's rolls in the last 20 months due to ineligibility. This follows a national push from the Republican National Committee and state committees to clean up voter rolls and strengthen election integrity efforts, with a particular focus on battleground states deemed critical to the outcome of the 2024 presidential election. Joining me now to discuss this is Hans von Spakovsky, manager of the Election Law Reform Initiative, the Heritage Foundation. He also served 2 years as a member of the Federal Election Commission, the authority charged with enforcing campaign finance laws for congressional and presidential elections. Hans, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So your thoughts on the latest developments out of North Carolina?
Well, I think this is great. In fact, election officials should be commended for doing actually what they're required to do under two separate federal statutes, which is maintain the accuracy of their voter rolls. That the 747,000 individuals they removed over the past year and a half are all folks who should not be on the rolls. According to the breakdown that they gave, they're people who have died, moved out of state, become convicted as felons, therefore losing their right to vote. In other words, all folks who are ineligible. In fact, a lot of them, apparently a fair number, were people who had two registrations in the state of North Carolina. And so what they did was remove one of the registrations. All of this is a good thing. Other states should all be following this example and doing exactly the same thing.
Well, Hans mentioned the number of 700,000 names that were removed.
Right.
Had this not been done, is this a situation where those, you know, dead persons, their names would have been in the voter rolls, but somebody would have had to come into an election place and claim to be them? And so in reality, those names would have just lied there dormant, and though on the rolls, nobody would have voted in their name? Or is this a situation where ballots are being mailed out in these persons' names, and so people would be getting multiple ballots, or dead people would be receiving ballots?
Well, fortunately, North Carolina is not one of the states that has moved to mailing out ballots to every single voter. You may know that's what they now do in Nevada. Very, very bad practice. But when you have names on the rolls of individuals who, for example, have moved out of state, Yeah, you know, someone can try to go in and vote in their name or just request an absentee ballot. So it's a good thing to take those names off. Again, you know, federal law requires that. And for folks who think this is a huge number, it's not. Consider the state has 7.7 million registered voters. So this is less than 10%. And remember, Americans have a very high mobility rate, right? Moving is a very big thing in America. Last time I looked, the numbers were over 10% of Americans, you know, average mobility rate. So this sounds about right in terms of how many people they ought to be taking off the rolls who are no longer eligible.
Hans, when we see this number, is it fair to conclude that 4 years ago in 2020, there were 700,000 names on the voter rolls that shouldn't have been? And therefore, does removing these names have a likelihood of making a difference in the upcoming election?
Well, it could definitely make a difference. Consider the fact that in 2008, Barack Obama won the state of North Carolina by only 14,000 votes. That's a very small number. You know, think about Georgia in the 2020 election where Donald Trump lost by only a little over 10,000 votes. In an election, particularly a presidential election, and certainly in local elections, close elections, these kind of names being on the rolls, names that could be used by people who want to cheat, can make a difference. And it's not like North Carolina is an extremely clean record there. They've recently prosecuted aliens for registering and voting in the state. You may recall in 2018, the State Board of Elections overturned a congressional race because of widespread absentee ballot fraud. You know, that's not that long ago.
Right. That's a really good point. And to that point about widespread absentee ballot fraud, you've been sounding the alarm on the potential for mail-in ballot fraud and kind of a chaos there. We have about a minute and a half left, but tell us what you're concerned about there and what should be done.
Well, if you check out the election fraud database that the Heritage Foundation maintains, you'll find that many of the cases involve absentee ballot fraud. Why? Well, because they're the only kind of ballots that are voted outside the supervision of election officials and outside the observation of poll watchers. States need to take steps to secure and increase the integrity of those. For example, Georgia extended its voter ID law, which used to only apply to in-person voting, to absentee ballots. Other states need to do exactly the same thing when they're handling and sending out absentee ballots.
Yeah. Well, we are, we all understand, at least intuitively, that when you just mail out ballots to everybody who wants them, and then you see what we're seeing today with the potential of 700,000 names being on a voter roll that shouldn't be on a voter roll, it's not difficult to understand why that would be a problem. And therefore, it's not difficult to understand why we should prevent that from happening. Hans von Spakovsky, thanks for so much for your time today.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
And when we come back, folks, we're going to have our worldview conversation with David Claussen. And when we do, we're going to talk a little bit about Israel, about the nature of the spiritual war taking place there, but also the nature of the ethics of war. Now, killing is always unfortunate. Sometimes it's justified, but even in a justified context, when does it become wrong? We're going to talk about that in our worldview conversation when we come back. Stay with us.
Join us October 3rd through the 6th as we gather with spiritually active, governance-engaged conservatives from across America at the Pray, Vote, Stand Summit in Washington, D.C. We'll pray for our nation, engage in government and culture, and stand for biblical truth alongside Christian leaders, worldview experts, and government officials. We'll discuss important issues like the sanctity of life, religious freedom, protecting students, strengthening families, praying for our nation, and how you can impact America's future from a biblical worldview. Our nation stands at a critical juncture, and we must ensure that the issues impacting faith, family, and freedom are understood and advanced. Register now at PrayVoteStand.org. That's PrayVoteStand.org.
Jesus said in John 15, "These things I've spoken to you, that my joy may remain in you and that your joy may be full." In 2024, in these divided and uncertain times, how can this be possible? By abiding in Him through His Word. At Family Research Council, we want to help you do that, which is the reason for the Stand on the Word Bible reading plan. In just 10 to 15 minutes each day, you will have read the entire Bible in just 2 years. But more importantly, you will be abiding in Him daily. Find our Bible reading plan at frc.org/Bible. And join Tony Perkins each weekday for a 10-minute devotional inspired by the daily reading and designed to encourage you on this journey through the Bible. Listen on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. And remember, the grass withers and the flower fades, but the word of our God will stand forever.
Research has found that there are 59 million American adults who are a lot like you. There are millions of people around the country who are born again, deeply committed to practicing their faith, and believe the Bible is the reliable Word of God. But that's not all. They're also engaged in our government. They're voters. They're more likely to be involved in their community, and they're making a difference in elections. The problem is that a lot of them feel alone too. We want to change that. FRC wants to connect these 59 million Americans to speak the truth together, no matter the cost. If you want to learn more about this group and what it means to be a spiritually active, governance-engaged conservative, or if you want to find out if you are one of these sage cons yourself, join us. Go to frc.org/sagecon, sagecon, to learn more. That's sagecon, sagecon, to learn more.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Joseph Backholm, sitting in for Tony today. Just a reminder, the Pray, Vote, Stand Summit takes place next week, October 3rd through the 6th in Washington, D.C. We would love to have you join us. So visit PrayVoteStand.org for more information and to register today. Also, I would like to again encourage you to nominate someone you think that is a defender of the faith. At FRC, we want to honor everyday defenders of the faith, from parents to pastors to teachers and pro-life volunteers. So submit your nominations and do so by texting the word AWARD to 67742. Text the word AWARD to 67742 to nominate someone to be a defender of the faith. Now, as we reported at the top of the program, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu addressed the United Nations General Debate this morning, defending his nation's battle for existence and for the hostages that the Hamas terror group continues to hold captive in Gaza. Throughout the week, speakers at the UN Assembly vilified the nation of Israel, including Mahmoud Abbas, the head of the Palestinian Authority.
It committed and continues to commit war crimes, as acknowledged by the international community. They're called war crimes. Israel today is now launching a new aggression on the brotherly Lebanese people. The Lebanese people are now being subjected to a war of genocide. And Israel must stop the war in Lebanon and in Palestine.
As Christians, how are we to view claims like these that Israel is the genocidal state, when, of course, Israel states that others are the genocidal state? Joining me for the weekly Worldview segment to discuss all of this and a bunch more is David Clausen, who is the director of the Center for Biblical Worldview at Family Research Council. David, thanks for joining me today.
Hey, great to be with you, Joseph.
So you heard those comments there from Mahmoud Abbas earlier in the program. We heard from Benjamin Netanyahu, of course, the Prime Minister of Israel, who ridiculed and mocked this idea that Israel was trying to commit a genocide and said, in fact, our enemies are the ones trying to commit a genocide. How do you think Christians should think through this kind of war of words, which is not merely a war of words?
No, it's not merely a war of words, Joseph. And over the last year, really since the October 7th attack in Hamas, or with Hamas invading Israel, we've seen this escalate to just really scary proportions. And of course, this is not new, Joseph. I've had the opportunity to go to Israel actually 9 times over the last couple of years. And just hearing from Israeli people, they live in a constant state of it's just almost psychological terror, not knowing when one of these terrorist attacks is going to happen. The Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, earlier this year has described what Israel is facing really as a 7-front war. When you think about not just the Hamas terrorist in the Gaza Strip, but the Hezbollah terrorist group in Lebanon, you have the Houthis in Yemen, you have Iranian proxies in Iraq and Syria, you have actually Iran itself attacking Israel back in April. And so I think for Christians looking at a story like this, this is why Christians are the people that are committed to truth. We are people that believe in objective truth, absolute moral truth, but we're people who actually care about the facts, Joseph. And I think that's why it's important when you see what's happening at the UN this week to realize that so much of it is just ridiculous. And why, again, I'm glad the Prime Minister came to New York, even though there's a war going on in Israel, to set the record straight.
Yeah. Well, you say that so much of it is ridiculous. And I think one of the hard parts for us to navigate is that while there's this assertion that it's ridiculous, there are a lot of very serious people saying things like, Israel is in the process of committing a genocide. And I've actually had the occasion to do dozens of interviews with Palestinian protesters and kind of people on the left generally. And when they talk about this, every single time someone will say, Israel is a genocidal state. They are trying to commit a genocide. We must stop them. That's why we need to free Palestine. And then the narrative goes on and on. And those are people here in the West who have clearly internalized that. And there is this psychological impact of when you hear something said over and over and over and over again, eventually you come to wonder, well, maybe it's actually true. And then we see Mahmoud Abbas say this at the UN. And then we see the UN itself passing resolutions that are essentially siding with Mahmoud Abbas against Israel. If their positions, as you say, are ridiculous, why does there appear to be so much support for them?
Yeah, and this has, again, been the case for decades, not just Abbas, but his predecessor, Yasser Arafat. They are propaganda geniuses in kind of getting this out there, Joseph. And I think, again, this is why facts are so important. We're all familiar with what happened on October the 7th with the Hamas terrorist attack. I think we're less familiar that the day after, on October 8th, Hezbollah began launching missiles. And, of course, Lebanon is where Hezbollah is located, which is north of Israel. And the Prime Minister mentioned this in his speech earlier today, Joseph. 60,000 Israelis have been evacuated from their homes. And since October the 8th, there's been 8,000 missiles and rockets shot from Lebanon, from these Hezbollah militants, Joseph. And so, again, I understand that the propaganda machine is very persuasive. And you have a lot of people that are sympathetic to the so-called Palestinian cause, that are, you know, really interested in this so-called settler colonial ideology that you and I have talked about before, which is just a form of identity politics. But again, as Christians, this is why the facts matter, Joseph. But I do think we still need to do the serious work of thinking through these things. Just a week ago, with this whole exploding pagers episode, as Christians, we need to think, because it's not that just anything Israel does is okay and morally permissible or morally praiseworthy. Again, as Christians, we need to think seriously kind of about all of these issues.
Yeah, and you mentioned it, so I'll let you take the baton and continue there. But that was an interesting, it was on one sense, this story of these exploding pagers was for all of us who just like wanted to be international men of mystery and, you know, and do covert things to destroy the bad guys. We're like, this is the best thing we've ever seen in our lives, right? And so they detonated thousands of pagers held by Hezbollah terrorists at the same time. And that's like one of the coolest warfare things we've ever seen. However, of course, course, as is the nature in everything in this conflict, that move had its critics. And they said, oh, you shouldn't have done that. That was careless. It was reckless. It was done with disregard for the potential risk to the lives of innocents. What do you think is the right way to view that tactic?
Yeah, and I think those are serious claims that are being made, that this was a breach of international law, this was morally impermissible. And again, facts are important.